Welcome to The Money Show on this Thursday night. Pavla Fatidis later on bemoaning, I think he's bemoaning. I mean, if you're upset, you'll be moaning, right? The lack of innovation in South Africa. We've got lots of people who are great innovators. We've seen some great businesses in South Africa created over multiple generations. But we're not an innovative culture. We're not creating brand new things all the time. We don't have the environment. We don't have that energy. We don't have that buzz, that vibe, that pierce, that great vuma to be a truly creative nation when it comes to innovation. Or am I wrong? 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. I'll let Pavla make the case later on. And then if you're in the fortunate enough position to have enough money that you know it will last you not only your lifetime, but there'll be enough to leave your kids, what should you be doing with that money? That's with Warren Ingram coming up. Also, we're trying to establish the exact status of KPMG and an investigation that the chief executive told us last night she wants to have held into the company that she now represents as chief executive. So we'll look at that because there's some controversy in accounting circles about that. Dennis George from Fidusa, 22/7 this evening, is going to join us and talk about why he is willing to take the pension money of his members out of the Public Investment Corporation. He's really concerned about Malusi Gigaba's comments to rival trade union COSATU that there's no guarantee that government won't touch pension money of civil servants in order to prop up failing state-owned enterprises. And Dennis George is concerned about that. In a moment, we'll talk interest rates. And then there is a report that the KPMG International Chief Executive is in South Africa. Flew in especially, we're told, this afternoon for a meeting with Pravin Gordhan. We'll pack up with a reporter who's all over that story this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter, at Bruce Business.
I can't speak with my tongue in my cheek, but it got kind of fast fact here. Okay, that's that kind of fast fact. I can't do it with my tongue in my cheek, but it's a tongue in your cheek kind of fast fact. Here's today's fast fact with MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. Where is Nambia? That's today's fast fact question. I'm perplexed. I've heard of this place called Nambia, and I'm looking for it on a map, and I've not been able to find Nambia. Where is Nambia? Now, if you know the answer to today's fast fact, let me know on our SMS lines, 31702 31567, or you can tweet me on @BruceBusiness.
The Money Show on your number one news and talk station.
What is it about the models that economists use to forecast interest rates that makes most of them wrong most of the time? It's true. I mean, I can hardly call myself an economic forecaster, but based on a couple of reasons last night, the chief one being because most economists said that there would be an interest rate cut, I said there probably wouldn't be. And so I watched this thing with a great deal of interest because reputation is huge, as you know. I was very grumpy with the Reserve Bank governor when he said that there wouldn't be an interest rate cut, but I agree completely with his rationale. There's just too much noise in the economy at the moment. And what was so interesting about today is the Monetary Policy Committee of the Reserve Bank is made up of 6 members. 3 of those members voted to leave interest rates unchanged, and 3 voted for a 25 basis point cut, split right down the middle. They'd have a long chat about it, no doubt, and eventually the consensus was that it was best to leave interest rates unchanged. Tendani Machimuli is the consumer economist at Liberty South Africa Retail. Have you ever seen such a close vote between members of the Monetary Policy Committee, a really divided set of opinions as to what is right for the country?
Good evening, Bruce. I think it's been a while since we had such a close call in terms of the decision being split in the middle. But I guess that is because, I mean, you could argue either way that leave interest rates unchanged for the reason that the governor mentioned. You could have also argued that we could afford to cut rates if you look purely at the economic data, leave out the political uncertainty, leave out the noise, look at the data, look at where inflation is headed to, look at the prospects of demand heating up and pushing inflation higher, minimal at the moment. So you could have argued less cut rates. But the governor, I agree with the governor in the sense that what he does mention is potentially going to have a huge impact on inflation, on growth, and the prospects of South Africa going forward. The fact that we are heading towards a huge period of uncertainty at the end of the year, from the political side, which has fiscal policy implications, which lends uncertainty to both business and foreign investor business in South Africa and foreign investors. We're heading towards a ratings decision in December. So, and it doesn't look like there's anything that has happened that would have enhanced investor confidence in South Africa. So I guess, yes, they were right. It's just too uncertain to make a call now.
I mean, as you point out, the data suggests that they should be perfectly comfortable to cut interest rates. Yes. But data is historical. Data looks backwards. What we don't know is what lies in the future. And what the flags that the Reserve Bank governor was waving today include an possible electricity price increase of 20% next year. Fuel prices up 86 cents a litre since August, and more to come in October. Political noise, ratings threats, ratings uncertainty. All of that suggests a very worried Reserve Bank governor about the state of our economy.
Agreed. And there is nothing that is suggesting that those things that he's worried about are going to change or going to come out for the better for South Africa. But for me, one positive to take out, if you just look at the economic data, is that inflation is going to remain within target up to 2019. The global environment currently is supportive to growth in South Africa. We are out of a technical recession, although what does worry me, though, is where that growth in the second quarter was coming from is not going to be sustainable. And you've seen that with the forecast for the annual growth rate, which is just going to be around 0.6%. And we are not going to see a growth rate anywhere close to 3%, anywhere close to growing, where the economy is going to create jobs. The other worrying thing, it's related to the uncertainty, is the fact that he singled out gross fixed capital formation by the business sector, down 6.9%. What supported capital formation this quarter, the second quarter, was spending by government. And you don't want that to be the driver of capital formation. But businesses are uncertain about the policy that is going to come, the policy outcome after the December conference. So that doesn't bode well for job creation. That doesn't bode well for anything that is going to stimulate the economy going forward.
Finally, please explain something here to me, Tendani. We've got inflation data, which tells us what the average inflation rate in South Africa is. We've got projections as to what the inflation rate is likely to do within a certain set of scenarios. And then we've got this thing called inflation expectations. It's what ordinary people expect to happen to inflation. And that is much, much worse than anything that the Reserve Bank is saying. What is this big gap between maybe what data-driven reality and what we as South Africans anticipate is likely to happen, because we've been bruised so many times by inflation in the past?
So the inflation that I experience as a consumer might seem higher than what the overall headline CPI is. If you look at transport inflation, for instance, much, much higher, driven by the cumulative increase in petrol prices. If a consumer is looking at what they spend on transport, which doesn't come down, their expectation is that things are going to get worse going forward. And I would agree with them. Supported with where the rand is, rand weakness going forward, what they experience is very different from what the headline CPI will tell you. As a business owner, you anticipate that the wage negotiations coming forward might actually put more pressure, and your employees might negotiate at higher than the headline CPI. So your anticipation of what inflation looks like going forward will be colored by those experiences.
Tendani Machibuli, thank you very much. The economist at Liberty this evening. Today's interest rate decision finally split between the hawks and the doves, which is coincidental, really, that it is such a nice split between those that want to cut interest rates and those that want to leave rates flat. Because a question that's been coming through a lot recently has been, what is a hawk? And that's got nothing to do with the Gupta emails and the fact that the police aren't doing anything about it. This is an economic hawk, not a lethargic hawk. What is the difference between a hawk and a dove in economic terms? That's the question that we're going to answer for you later on our Money Show FAQs.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Lots of rumors doing the rounds, and then it appeared to be a confirmation this afternoon that the KPMG International Chair, John Vermeer, requested a meeting with Pravin Gordhan and seems to have flown to South Africa specifically for a meeting that started at 3:30 this afternoon. Polly van Wyk is a journalist with Scorpio, the investigative arm of the Daily Maverick. Have you managed to establish this as absolute fact, Polly?
Hello. Yes, indeed, it is so. It's an absolute fact that they're meeting. And but we're not sure if they're still busy with their meeting, but it seems to be a long one.
Is this something that was called at short notice? Has this been arranged for a long time?
No, the background to this is that after Friday's shock admission by KPMG, Pravin Gordhan came out really strong, and he said maybe one of the strongest themes of his statement was that he would initiate or look into initiating legal action. And John's office phoned him, or their mayor's office phoned him over the weekend and asked for this meeting. There were no real clarity from their side about what this meeting would be. They might have just said that the South African CEO, Nhlamo Dlomo, would assist or would be sitting into the meeting. And Pravin Gordhan also thought of asking his former Deputy Minister of Finance, Tabisi Jonas, to attend. I also don't have clarity at the moment if Jonas is in fact there. The meeting was arranged for today at 3:30 in Johannesburg, and seems as if they might still be busy.
Okay, do we know where the meeting is happening?
Not in Johannesburg, somewhere.
Ooh, in Johannesburg. It's a big place, Polly. It's a big place. Good luck finding it. If you find it before 8 o'clock, and also if you happen to trip past the Saxon Wall Tribune and find that, we'd love to know where that is too. But Polly van Wyk, thank you very much. Journalist with Scorpio, the investigative arm of the Daily Maverick. Confirmation this evening that, and this is how seriously KPMG International is taking the threat by Pravin Gordhan, who must be spitting mad at the way in which the report, the rogue report into SARS and Project Sunday Evenings, how that was manipulated and used not only against senior executives at SARS, but also used as a stick with which to bludgeon him personally. And it led to an enormous amount of distress and stress, not only for him, but for the country as a whole. Remember those charges? The time for questioning the National Prosecuting Authority is over. And 2 weeks later, "Except for me," said Sean Abrams. And then he second-guessed himself and the charges were dropped. And more recently, there have been attempts to try and reinstate those charges. And there were calls for Jabu Moleketi, there were demands for Jabu Moleketi and Trevor Manuel to file affidavits. And it's also got to be linked to the same rogue report. So yeah, it's caused an absolute shambles and a complete kerfuffle in South Africa. Yeah, I think it's a good word for it. It's a kerfuffle. You rearrange the letters and it spells all kinds of other words, I suppose. You could make all sorts of words out of that. But yeah, it's been shambolic and there's a lot to answer for. And I'm delighted. I'm really pleased that the KPMG International Chair, John Vermeer, sees it necessary to take time out of his no doubt busy schedule to come and talk to Pravin Gordhan about it. Pravin Gordhan's people, friends of Pravin Gordhan, if he could chat to us about that meeting, we'd be inclined to agree to a time this evening on 011-883-0702. Lines are open.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, markets today did absolutely nothing. Nothing. They went nowhere. The level of the market is the same as it was this time yesterday. Look, there was a lot of noise and activity in between, but they didn't even open on time today. Nick Norman-Smith from Lentis Asset Management. Do we know why?
Yeah, perhaps they should have just stayed closed, Bruce. A bit of a...
Well, there was absolutely no point, was there, in opening the front door of the JSE today. Everyone could just play golf or taking the day off or something.
Perhaps they were actually prescient. But, there was just a technical glitch. We haven't experienced this for a while. It does happen every now and then, of course. Remember, the JSE is just an IT company, and occasionally computer systems break, and clearly they broke this morning and they had to reset it, which delayed the start of the market. So probably caused a lot of stress for some short-term traders, but it did eventually open.
Nicky Newton-King has just driven into a light post. The JSE is just a technology company. Discuss.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember in the old days there were people shouting and trading shares on a floor like any old market. Now the JSE building is a bunch of computers with algorithms that matches buyers and sellers. So there were quite a few issues a few years ago when they were using a lot of the London Stock Exchange system, and then they would often blame the undersea cable between here and London. A lot of that's been moved locally, and it does seem that the system's been a lot more stable. But as you know, with your PC, occasionally things do go wrong. Of course, it's a little bit stricter and more well sort of reinforced. But I don't know the exact cause of this this issue, but it does happen every now and then.
It's an IT company with regulatory oversight of companies. Okay, the Gupta bank accounts. Now, finally, boy, it's taking an awfully long time to tighten this particular noose. But finally, Bank of Baroda is empowered to give the Guptas their marching orders.
Yeah, fantastic. Once again, the markets proved to be a better arbiter than politicians and regulators do. So, fantastic news, I think. And you know, we saw what happened with Bell Pottinger. We've seen the pressure that's been put on KPMG. So, let the markets continue to clean out anyone who's been complicit in this, and hopefully it will make people think twice before aiding and abetting these kind of organizations in the future.
Yeah, and that's a big one. And again, it's just it's a bit like sheepdog corralling sheep, and it's to closing every corner and making sure that none of the sheep escape out of a gate or through a hole in the fence. And there's a gradual shepherding of the Guptas towards, we hope, an answerable future. PPC, now here's South Africa's great cement maker. It's up for sale. We know this. There are lots of people around the continent looking to do deals. They're Canadian interest, and of course, then there's the mighty Dangote Cement, which is very keen, and those talks seem to be continuing.
Yeah, I think it would be a perfect fit. You know, this is a business that's obviously got itself into trouble with some poor capital allocation decisions and capital planning decisions. Add on the fact that the construction market's been very tough, and they've been expanding into Africa. But the reality is, it's still got a great set of assets across the continent. Obviously, mainly focused in South Africa, but in other markets as well. A lot of those are new. Smarter and higher specification plants compared to what there is in South Africa that are just coming on stream. So I think it would make a perfect fit for a company like Dangote. Dangote Cement is significantly bigger than PPC. I think probably around 10 times the size in terms of market cap. And their balance sheets are relatively strong. So I think if you add that to the strategic nous and the ability to really operate very efficiently in Africa, I think it would and, you know, the assets would be very well placed to be in their hands. How it ends up happening, given that there's obviously some political issues and the PRC seem to be backing the AfriSam bid, time will tell. But certainly this is a great set of assets that are underpriced, and the market's showing us once again that doesn't stay like that for long.
But certainly doesn't. And there's a guy called Agarwal who is seeing something in Anglo-American that many other investors are not seeing. He's now got 20% of the shares.
Yeah, so this is an Indian mining business and mining investors. So they bought a stake in Anglo a while ago, and announced yesterday that they're going to be upping that stake to around 20%. Says that this isn't a takeover bid, but I guess time will tell. But yeah, once again, we've seen a bit of a rebound in these businesses, and he's obviously seeing a good set of assets. This is a business again that's been cleaned up after the quagmire that was in a while ago, and with a bit of stabilization in the resource market, it's obviously nowhere near its peak. They've got a great set of assets sitting there, also probably still quite underpriced in the market, and betting on the fact that I think he's quite positive on the South African assets. So using the Buffett quote of being greedy when others are fearful. So positive for Anglo shareholders to see such a big interest in the business.
It's nice to know somebody's positive on South Africa. Honestly, it is. I mean, we looked at today's Reserve Bank Monetary Policy Committee, and the MPC doesn't seem to be that. Well, at least half the members of the MPC are not entirely positive about the short-term future of the country.
Yeah, I guess they are all economists or similar to economists, so they're maybe paid to worry. And are always going to look at maybe the slightly negative side. But yeah, I guess you probably want someone who's a little bit more cautious than someone who's overly optimistic when making these decisions. But it's a tough one. I often hear the adage of being a central banker is you're driving a truck with no windscreen, and the only thing you've got to steer you is looking in the rearview mirror. And I think that's certainly the case here. So it's very difficult to make these decisions, and you often look like an idiot in hindsight. But we couldn't even predict whether there was going to be a rate cut or not. So trying to predict what's going to happen in the future is very, very difficult to do.
So what is going to happen in the future, Nick? Oh, look at the time. Nick Norman-Smith from Lentus Asset Management. Thank you very much indeed, our market commentator this evening. In a couple of minutes, I'll bring you the answer to today's Fast Fact, courtesy of MTN Business. And the question in today's Fast Fact, where is Nambia? Some lovely answers. I'll share some of those with you in a bit. Well, earlier in today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I asked you, where is Nambia? And it's so sweet that somebody would be taking it so seriously. Namibia. You know, it's Namibia, you know. Donald Trump just got it wrong. Yes, we know he got it wrong, but we're taking the mickey out of Donald because yes. Nambia is due south of Anglia. That's funny. It's near Kofefe. Nambia is the capital of Windhoek, says somebody else. There are lots of different versions of this particular little joke. And yes, dear Donald Trump, last night at a dinner with African leaders, and I think President Jacob Zuma was there as well, he was talking about Nambia. Well, the truth is Nambia doesn't exist. If it did, it would have the capital of Kofefe, and its population would be Bigly. That's courtesy, of course, of Tom Eaton, because Tom Eaton's the clever guy. I would think it's probably somewhere near the Saxon Wald Shebeen is Nambia. But yeah, we don't get a namby-pamby about this one. Donald Trump got it horribly wrong. But what was so awful and Donald Trumpish about this, he looked around the room and he looked at these African leaders. He goes, hey, you got, I got friends who come to your guys' countries and trying to get rich. That's going to endear him even more to us.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Well, this time last week, I was asking the Deputy Finance Minister, Sifiso Buthelezi, who, because of that position, is also the chairperson of the Public Investment Corporation. I was asking him very pointed questions about whether or not he had confidence in the chief executive of the Public Investment Corporation, Daniel Machila. And if reports were at that time that he was going to be replaced at a board meeting on Friday. And so the Deputy Finance Minister expressed confidence, and he said that the position of the chief executive was secure. And Friday came, and then Friday evening there was a board statement, full support with a twist. And it further raises speculation as to whether or not the chief executive of the PIC's position is secure, whether or not he's being set up for failure. And if you connect the dots, it's possible to see a scenario where a chief executive is removed and replaced with somebody less obstructive, let's put it that way, to the desire of the state to use money that is meant to be for the pensions of civil servants to bail out entities like SAA. Let's talk to Dennis George, the Secretary General at FDUSA, the Federation of Unions of South Africa, because today, Dennis George, you've threatened to withdraw your members' pension fund money from the PIC. I didn't even know that was legal to do so. I thought you were obliged to keep the money there, but you're not.
No, there's nothing in the law that say you have to use the PIC as an asset management company. I mean, the provision is there for the board to determine the mandate, and then after mandate, they determine the allocations in terms of where the money must be invested. But the mere fact that the minister mentioned this thing at a meeting with Kusatu to say this is what government are thinking, to bail out state-owned enterprises, you know, for us is totally unacceptable.
Why does that scare you? What is your concern?
I mean, look, you cannot, as a trustee or a director that's in a fiduciary responsibility, go and take your money and put it at serious risk. I mean, that is the reason why the banks put SAA on terms. To say, look, you are going to replace the chairperson. The CIPC have indicated to the minister very clearly that what he did to extend the contract till the next AGM of the chairperson is illegal. So the minute when you start violating good corporate governance, then all the warning lights are starting to go on. The second thing is this, there's a lot of trust deficit currently in the system. If a person also look what KPMG, you know, have done And if a person look at another company like Eskom, the McKenzie scenario where the minister had to force that board to say, look, come clean, I'm not happy with your answers. So all these kinds of things, and including the issue at Praza. At Praza, the minister was quick after he was appointed by the president with the latest reshuffle. He just wanted to get rid of Popo Molefe. He had to go to court. Now the board is, there's no board in Praza.
So now, what would you do with the money out of the PIC? Because you've got, you're the second biggest trade union federation in the country. There is, what, 1.9 trillion rand sitting in the PIC, of which several hundred million must be due to your members. It's the contributions that they've made to their future, to their retirements. What would you do with that money if you removed it from the PIC?
Look, I mean, when it comes to allocations to asset management companies, I think, you know, we need to push this particular question further and say, look, if other asset management companies are registered with the Financial Services Board and they comply with those kind of requirements, then money can also be allocated to them. You know, so there's no monopoly that the PIC has over the Government Employee Pension Fund. And therefore, you know, they must understand who is the dog and who's the tail.
What will get you to keep your money with the PIC? What will give you confidence to keep your money there?
Look, I mean, if you look today at the statement of the Reserve Bank, the governor of the Reserve Bank and the Monetary Policy Committee said this political uncertainty is the problem. And people are keeping their hopes up till after December to see what is going to happen. And that is the reason why we've decided to embark on this thing where we warn government. And I must say, after we gave the warning to them on Friday, on Saturday morning, I had a meeting with the chairperson of the PIC, who's also the Deputy Minister of Finance. And he came to me and said, look, they want Fedusa to know there's no plans to replace the CEO. They also issued a statement to the public, but we must be vigilant. We must look after the interests of our members. You know, even though we meet with them, you know, it doesn't mean that we're just going to trust blindly. We will trust, but we will verify at the same time.
Dennis George, the Secretary General of FEDUSA, Federation of Unions of South Africa. Critical point that he makes there. Got to be vigilant, got to watch this money. This is the money that is designated, it's been saved by state pensioners, by people who work within the public sector. If you're one of those people, it's an attempt to get grubby paws on your money to bail out failing state institutions without any guarantee that the way in which those state institutions are going to be run is going to be any different to what it was in the past. So it's going to be throwing good money after bad. That's what Dennis George is concerned about. That's what you should be concerned about. And that's what we should all be concerned about.
The Money Show. FAQs.
Frequently asked questions, FAQs, brought to you by Automechanica, Africa's largest automotive aftermarket trade show, 27th to the 30th of September at NASREC. Pre-register now and they'll let you in for nothing, for free. It's great. Nothing, not much is for free nowadays. Now, three members of the Monetary Policy Committee voted for a 25 basis point cut. Three voted for rates to remain flat. That means that half of the Monetary Policy Committee is hawkish, and the other half is dovish. But which is which? It's a frequently asked question. So frequent, Busi Khadebe, the economist at Nedbank. I'm sure we've answered this one before.
We have, Bruce. But so we'll try it again one more time.
No, well, maybe it was such a long time ago and people sort of forget. So let us refresh everybody's memory. What is a hawk and what is a dove? A hawk is supposed to be a police officer with super... No, not that kind of hawk.
Not that kind of hawk.
In an economic policy context, what's a hawk, what's a dove?
I mean, if you think about monetary policy, you want to think about inflation and you want to think about the tolerance for high inflation. So if I think of a hawk, it's someone who actually does not have a very high tolerance for high inflation. And if I think of a dove, that person is the kind of person that goes, you know what, I care maybe on the one side more about employment, and I actually can tolerate sort of a bit of more high inflation. So the one is actually very, very strict when it comes to inflation. So any sign that we're going sort of above that 6% target, that hawk will say, okay, let's raise rates. And then the dove will go, you know what, let's look at the picture here. Okay, if that means on the margin, sort of in the short term, we might get sort of a low unemployment rate, let's let inflation run a bit. Then they say, okay, we'll let inflation run a bit. So the one is strict on inflation, the hawk, and the other one has a tolerance for high inflation, the dove, a higher tolerance.
Okay. So, I mean, and it's so interesting. I don't know. I mean, I asked this question earlier as to if we've ever had such an evenly split monetary policy committee between leaving rates flat and actually cutting. Because today it was three all.
I mean, I haven't, for a long time, usually it's unanimous or we haven't actually had something like this. And it was actually, it's understandable to think we'd have something like this. I think most economists thought we would probably have a cut because the window was there to actually have a cut this time, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Bruce, I was listening to your earlier interview. We don't know, but this was the window. The rand is still kind of under control. It's still kind of, okay, inflation is coming down. Growth is actually weak. So now this is your window. We don't know what's going to happen in December. So we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what the rand is going to do in December. So it's understandable that there was probably a long debate and some people were saying, you know what, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So maybe this is the window. And some people go, you know what, everything looks very confusing. Everything looks very sort of not very calm at the moment. There's a lot of volatility, so maybe we need to wait. So I haven't had it in sort of a long time where we've had evening split, but this time that was it.
Okay, Busqadebe, thank you very much indeed for explaining it so beautifully. The difference between a dove and a hawk, your frequently asked question, asked, yes, and answered. Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. If you've got Private Gordon's cell phone number, please would you dial it and see if he answers. And when he answers, say The Money Show's looking for him, because The Money Show wants to talk to him about the meeting today with the chief executive of KPMG International. He would love to be a fly on the wall of that conversation. I can't imagine it was particularly comfortable for the man from KPMG. It's such an interesting judgment today, as the High Court dismissing the Gupta's Baroda Bank application. They wanted to effectively have the Bank of Baroda forced to continue providing banking services. And the High Court said, no, they're perfectly within their rights to deny you banking services, just as other banks have denied you banking services. But here's a part of the judgment. You need to read the whole judgment, but here's an extract. Do the constitutional obligations imposed upon the prosecuting authority still exist? What? Do the various investigating bodies of the police service still remember their constitutional duty to combat and investigate crime? It is so magnificent in its simplicity, and it's the question that you're asking all the time, because I'm curious as to why when we see lots of blue lights at the Saxon World Tribune, but they tend to go inside and spend a while and then leave later and with no extra occupants. Lots of you want extra occupants in those blue light brigades. Here's a High Court judge saying, hold on a second, things just don't add up. Welcome to The Money Show. Warren Ingram standing by. We'll chat to him in a moment or two about personal finance. And Pavlo this evening is to the problem with innovation in South Africa. Now, there's a big drive and a better drive to understand this mess around SARS and KPMG. What transpired between the two that enabled the tax collector to use a report compiled by the audit firm to root out senior staff. KPMG then, last week, withdrew that report. SARS this week said KPMG had no power to withdraw that report because SARS owned that report. It had paid $23 million. No fear, says KPMG, your $23 million, here, you can have it back. SARS isn't interested. But KPMG says that the report wasn't compiled properly. It doesn't stand up to their normal practices. And also, it seems to have been manipulated in a way that wasn't intended by the authors of the original report. But why didn't KPMG stand up for itself and distance itself publicly from this report long ago? It has to have known. And I know there have been journalists who have sent evidence to KPMG to say, we think that your report is being misused. Nobody at KPMG stood up and said, actually, this report needs to be withdrawn. Nobody did until last Friday. KPMG now wants to have an investigation done into itself independently. And we had, as you know, the chief executive, the new chief executive of KPMG South Africa, Nhlamo Dlomo, in studio with us last night. And already this idea of this independent investigation seemed to be caught up in some controversy, because last night Nhlamo Dlomo suggested SAICA, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, might be the right guys to do it.
In the past 4 days, 4 to 5 days, what I've been doing is engaging with our stakeholders, our clients, our people, and really listening carefully to what people are saying to us. And I can hear the loud call to have something that is more objective to oversee the work that International has done. So in our conversations, we have agreed with SAICA that...
this is South African Institute of Chartered Accountants.
That it would be appropriate to set up an inquiry into the matters and to
ensure... But hasn't that already happened with KPMG International? What did they do if that wasn't an inquiry?
KPMG International ran a detailed investigation into and reviewed a lot of detail into what happened. And they produced the results, which were summarized into an 11-page statement, which is what we released on Friday. What this would be is an additional assurance lens to ensure that the public in South Africa can truly see that we've opened up our doors. We want to be clear about what has happened so that we can explain this, besides having a KPMG International lens, have a South African lens of completely independent parties looking at this.
No sooner had that interview finished, I got an email from the guys at the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. And they said, no, SAICA can't do that. SAICA can't have an investigation. They're not the regulator. We're the regulator. So Bernard Agulhas, Chief Executive of the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, says it would be wrong to assume that the membership organization for accountants, that's SAICA, the guys that their job is really to administer the CASA designation. They decide whether or not you've got what it takes to be a chartered accountant. It would be wrong for SAICA to investigate KPMG. And he's traveling at the moment, as Bernard Agulhas, but he sent us a voice note.
It is not helpful to feel panic on speculation and assumptions. The RBA is independent and will not be influenced to favour any predetermined outcome. Neither will it compromise the robustness of its investigation. We will follow our due process in terms of the requirements in the Auditing Profession Act to draw the investigation to its rightful conclusion. With regard to the speculation surrounding a possible investigation by SAICA, it is important to understand that SAICA is a member body for chartered accountants and as such does not have the legal mandate to conduct independent inquiries into the conduct of registered auditors or firms, which is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the RBA. I appeal to everyone to respect the RBA's due process and allow it to run its proper course. It is critical for the reputation of the profession and the stability of our capital markets that we are responsible in our commentary on this matter.
Now, here's the problem, though, with that. Thank you, Bernard Agulhas, who sent us that voice note. But here's the problem. It takes so long. It takes so long for the regulator to make headway. Now, everybody I talk to about this tells me it's money. And it's a question of this independent regulatory board, which is massively under-resourced. It goes up against the industry, the accounting industry, which has got deep pockets and expensive lawyers. And IRBA will send questions and the lawyers will send questions back. And the questions then, eventually the message is so diluted that the regulator, I am guessing, becomes quite frustrated by this process. And it's taken an awfully long time. Remember Deloitte is accused of not doing his job properly with respect to African Bank. And African Bank went down, 2-3 years ago? And still investigations are ongoing there. And it doesn't help that these investigations are so long and so drawn out. And that's why it's good that KPMG International has stepped in and just gone, no. Reputation is everything. We've got to sort this out. And it's taken some very dramatic steps. If it had been to the regular regulatory processes in South Africa, it would take a whole lot longer. And we don't have time. We really don't have time. Well, today there was an invitation in my inbox from Terence Nombembe. He is the chief executive of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. He's going to be announcing an independent commission of inquiry into the conduct of certain members of SAICA employed by KPMG. So there will be people with the CASA designation whose role in this sorry mess is going to be challenged by SAICA. That's where SAICA has got authority. It can withdraw the designation of CASA, which would be disastrous for the people who worked at KPMG, who've quit KPMG, maybe even some people who still work at KPMG, because they'll never be able to operate a CASA again if SAICA should withdraw that designation. If they think that people have overstepped the mark and haven't been responsible as chartered accountants, they've got the power to do that. The regulator, IRBA, has got to look at the whole of the company. SAICA can look at the individuals working in or having recently worked for the company.
The Money Show, Personal Finance.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital. He's a financial advisor. He's a director at Galileo Capital. You're talking a fiction tonight. You're talking about a world where parents have money to leave their kids.
Still exists. I suppose
there must be 12 people in the world who can still afford to do that.
Ah, oh, come on. This is the uplifting part of the show.
Okay, all right. Now tell me in this fantasy world in which you live about these special people who at the end of their lives, there's anything left to leave the kids.
So I think maybe it starts a little bit before the end of their lives, because it'll be parents who might just have enough, you know, when their kids are born and they look at their budget and they say to themselves, okay, we can set aside enough money to put our kids through school and university, and you know, we can feed ourselves and look after our own retirement planning as well, but we still have a little bit of money left over to look after our kids' future as well. So it's not necessarily someone who's, you know, at age, you know, 79 and actually say they're probably a year, you know, living in a year of credit, who then wants to leave behind millions and millions. And, you know, this is just responsible parents who have a bit of a gap in their budget. And what's interesting about this kind of an exercise is they need to think, 20 to potentially 60 years ahead of where they are today. So they need to have a completely different mindset with this kind of money, as opposed to the money that they need for themselves, their retirement, and I guess even just their kids' education.
This takes a remarkable amount of planning, though. This takes a huge amount of organization. You can safely project your income over the next, say, 20 years if you're somebody who's 40 or 50 and you plan to work for another 20 years. You can safely project your income. You can safely predict what your expenses are going to be. You can safely predict how much you can put away for your retirement and be sure that that's going to be enough. And then there's this magical bit of cash left over. That's this bubble that you're talking about.
Exactly right, yeah. And I think there are a couple of things. One, it's such a long time frame away that you can't possibly try and anticipate or even try and predict everything that's going to happen. You need to start with saying to yourself, I don't even know what I don't know in a situation like this. So I need to plan cleverly, and I need to spread the money as far and as wide as possible, because that's the only way that you hope that a good portion of the money will be immune to as many unforeseen events as possible. So I think that's one important thing is think beyond just your own, you know, your own kind of set of concerns and your own bubble as you know it now, and try and spread that money as far as possible. And we see some really sad examples of this, not going well. For example, in Zim, where, you know, families would say, you know, we've got a family farm, and the father who launched the farm says, on my passing, the farm goes into trust, and the farm may never be sold. And we know what happened in Zim, and those families got stuck in a situation where they just can't sell an asset that the father, you know, really thought would be in the family for the next, you know, multiple generations. So this kind of money, what you need to do is protect it from one point of view. In other words, protect it so that the children don't get access to it on the day they turn 18 and they go and spend it on a nice sports car and big round the world holiday. But at the same time, don't lock it in such a way that it cannot be accessed for the right reasons in the right circumstances. And so to me, you know, a couple of things. One, you need to look at, for example, what happens with education. So let's say your children are 3, 4, 5 years old now, and you want to protect them against the future. One of those things might be, if we look at the whole fees must fall issue last year, we don't know what form our universities are going to be in 20 years' time. And so you need to be able to say, well, you know, potentially what I need to do is start saving for my kids' education in a situation where they might need to be schooled outside of the country. You know, if universities, you know, aren't protected and don't go well, you know, where are we going to put our kids? And so that means that you might well need to start overseas investments for your children, even though they're only 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And at the same time, you know, this sort of migration of children, you know, especially educated kids in sort of, you know, knowledge industries that might just want to move around the world. You know, you need to say to yourself, okay, I can't just invest everything they have in just in South Africa, because they might need to access that money in dollars or pounds or euros or yen or the one, you know. So I think you've got to think about that as well. And then we've got to look at things like taxes. You know, one of the things that you've got to be careful of is what happens when you start investing money now for your children. If you're putting it all in your own name, and at age 25 or 30 you want to give that to the kids at that point, if it's all in your name, that means you're paying major donations taxes. So what's the most effective way to try and do some planning of tax as well? So there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, there's a huge amount going on, and there's plenty of food for thought. But I know people who look at their young children, and their young children are perfect, and they're wonderful, and they're so cute and bubbly and charming, and they're polite and sweet. Yet they've seen so many families go wrong with leaving legacies for kids and leaving money in children's names that when the kids do turn 18 and the money becomes rightfully theirs to do with as they please, they do go off the rails. And possibly by that point they've fallen in with a bad crowd, or they've got themselves into some kind of trouble, social trouble, whatever it might be. And suddenly this money actually becomes quite destructive in their lives. And it's that ability to relinquish control of the funds and trusting in a positive future for your kids, in which your kids take the life lessons they learn at the dinner table and apply them well, and a future where actually the money becomes a tool of self-destruction.
So I think there are two aspects to this. One will be an educational and almost social responsibility that you have as a parent, and the other is then straight sort of nuts and bolts legal technical issues. So just the legal technical issues, you know, one of the best ways to protect your kids from, I guess, potentially from themselves, would be to set up a trust for the reason that trusts should be set up. You know, not a tax dodge, not a way to, you know, to shaft SARS or anybody else, but it's a way to ensure an orderly transfer of capital from one generation to the next. And in a trust, you could say, right, this trust is set up for the purpose of, number one, making sure that the kids are provided for if myself and my wife pass away, but secondly, you know, that if they do pass away when the kids are only 21, 22, that they can only access the money potentially at their age 25 or 30 once they've achieved certain benchmarks, either it be, you know, tertiary education, or they've started employment, or that they want to use the money for further education and they can't afford it, you know, that the trust then pays for that without just giving them just a major lump sum of money that they just can afford to, or can just blow without control, without restriction. So there a trust can be extremely valuable. But again, just be careful if you're the parent setting up that trust that you do it, you know, properly, so that you don't, you know, rule from the grave where you say, you know, they can never access the money in any circumstance except, you know, R1,000 a month, you know, something silly, which I have seen in trust deeds, because
what?
You know, 20 years time, R1,000 a month is
lacks so much foresight. You know, you have people who make financial commitments or make financial decisions today based on thinking that it will be the same 20 years from now, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Exactly, yeah. So I think, you know, set some principles in there which are important, but then give the trustees an element of discretion to use that money in a wise way for the benefit of the children. And I think, you know, that leads then to the social part of your job as a parent, the educational part, which is, you know, don't hide money conversations from your children, you know, when they're young. You've got to expose them to sensible financial decisions, make them part of the family budgeting exercise, test them with small amounts of money in the beginning, you know, and see how they make money decisions. Help them, you know, set up investment portfolios, you know, even if it's small amounts, and get them used to the idea of thinking, you know, thinking down the line, thinking about the future and delaying the sort of instant gratification urge that we all have, and see how they deal with it. And what you find is if you make that part of the family conversation over time, that becomes something that they get used to. And then, you know, when they do get to the position where they've got to manage money, they're not spoiled by the money. They're actually, it's just part and parcel of life, and they're able to think rationally about it and make good decisions. If you're in a situation where that doesn't work, then that's where the trust is really going to be helpful.
Okay. But trusts are expensive to set up. They're expensive to administer. But your suggestion there is that they can actually offset a lifetime of heartache and potentially money wastage.
Yeah. Absolutely. And to me, that, you know, it's massively valuable. But as you say, they are expensive. So what happens if you're the normal salary Joe that is never going to be able to afford to set up a trust and pay lawyers to do all these things. Just remember that, for example, things like your retirement fund, you can leave that to your kids. And if they're 21, they're not going to be able to access that necessarily until they're 55. So there's some clever things that you can do with retirement funds as well that will at least delay things like estate duty and executor's fees and to some extent limit your children's ability to access their money. And, you know, I keep thinking, a lot of parents are very cleverly now setting up tax-free savings accounts for their kids when their kids are 3 or 4 or 5 years old. And what happens if you're a parent and your child is 17 and you realize that in a year's time they're going to turn 18 and have access to that money and your child has gone off the rails? You just realize that this is going to be a big issue. To me, one of the things that you could really consider, it's a desperate measure, but it's something to consider, is transfer that money into a retirement annuity for that child. Because then that they've got a long-term investment that's going to grow tax-free, but they can't access it until they're 55. And hopefully by then life is, you know, back on track. And if not, at least you know that they can't access all of it. They are going to be able to have to draw pension with the bulk of the money.
They're not going to like you very much for it, but this isn't a popularity contest. This is making sensible financial decisions in the best interests of your family. Crucial. Absolutely crucial listening. Warren Ingram, thank you so much. Personal financial advisor, executive director, Galileo Capital. I do have to ask you something, though. I'm seeing an unusual amount of social media activity around your book. Your books.
Books.
It's weird. I mean, you wrote these things years ago, and we spoke about them a lot at the time, and people would like them. But it's suddenly like you've been discovered. Did you pop a couple into a library or something?
No, I don't. I didn't. I think I did. I did a couple of charity talks. Aimed at sort of younger investors, and that seems to have kicked it off again. But beyond that, it just seems to have its own life and carries on. I mean, one of your colleagues asked me to sign one of my books, which has been very well read, by the looks of it, for one of their family members. So I think it's one of those things that people are worried about money now, and I think they're looking for good information and trying to plan for their futures, which might be difficult.
Did I punt Warren Ingram's books, How to Be Your Own Financial Advisor, and also Make Your First Million? Of course, he should have written the first one second, the second one first. He should have, but he didn't ask. Planning. He's good at financial planning. Warren Ingram, financial planner at Galileo Capital.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pavlo Fatidis, the founder, the chief executive, the chief cook and bottle washer at Auric Business Accelerator, our small business focus. Now, innovation, you're not saying that we're rubbish at innovation. I'm not saying we're rubbish at innovation. The World Bank, however, says South Africa sucks at innovation.
Yeah, it's very concerning, Bruce. Because, you know, I read the article, I read through it, and I read between the lines and the back of it, the front of it. And unfortunately, I agree with a lot of what was said in that article. And based on the experience that I've had working in the States and in Europe specifically, we really are falling behind horribly in the innovation space. And the reason it's so bad for us is innovation has a way of growing the pie. And in a country where we're trying to include more and more people into the economy, innovation is a very definitive way of achieving that. It's also the domain of small business, and that's what the World Bank article was specifically focusing on.
But okay, I mean, innovation is such a misused term. It's one of my worst words in the world. There was a lot of advertising campaigns around innovation. Innovation was the new oxygen, and everybody was innovating. You have to be innovative. And I still don't really know really what it means. I mean, you do things something differently to everyone else, or you do it better. Whatever it might be, I still don't really understand innovation. It's a very broad catch-all term for what happens when you've run out of ideas? I don't know. What is it?
It's a little bit, remember that word that used to be used so frequently, synergies? Ooh. It was one of those types of words. Innovation, and you're exactly right. It's really not that complicated to identify and define it. It's about doing what's being done out there differently for users that gives them better value. And value is either an improved price, an improved opportunity to make money, improved efficiency, it saves time, it's convenience, it's ease, etc., etc., etc. It doesn't need to be complicated, but innovation must be defined in the hands of the person who's meant to be the recipient of that innovation.
So why is it not happening?
Well, there are a couple of things. You know, at a human level in South Africa right now, there's a very, very low confidence in business. And Bruce, innovation takes a long time to develop. It comes at tremendous cost. It comes at tremendous risk. It takes a couple of iterations and a couple of years and sometimes many years to develop. It doesn't just simply emerge overnight. You know, we suddenly see something innovative and we think that it popped up overnight. So when we have an environment where people are very reticent or apprehensive about investing because they're uncertain about the medium term, the medium to long term, it stalls it. Secondly, that money doesn't want to follow suit. The money that's out there at the moment is following the deals that are in businesses up and running with proven track records, post-revenue, in other words, they're earning revenue, and it's next stage of growth. Because within that environment, you have a more tradable asset, you can get your money in, you can get your money out, and the money that's available out there saying, well, I don't really want to test these long-term strategies that may or may not work. Third reason, we have a massive crisis in education in this country, Bruce, and I'm not sure that people understand the exact extent of it, but it is profoundly setting us back. You know, I read a report from, I think it was the World Economic Forum, where we managed to achieve position number 138 out of 138 countries in STEM education, which is science, technology, engineering and maths. And a lot of the innovation that is available out there, a lot of the thinking that's needed out there requires those forms of discipline to make them so. And then if we look at it from an environment point of view, our environment could not be better. And that's the irony. Our economy is terrible. The environment, the global environment, the climatic environment is terrible. Cape Town is desperate for water. Other areas are desperate for less rain or more rain. But there's so much agitation in the environment. There are so many problems within big businesses, within government. There are so many social pressures. And that creates a very, very fertile environment for people to do things differently that can help them achieve better opportunities.
And we've got lots of great examples of South African success stories. People have succeeded against the odds. But these people are the exceptions rather than the rule. And somehow we need to change the story around this. Somehow we need to make it the rule rather than the exception, that there are people in South Africa perfectly capable of changing the way their world works that can innovate their way through all of the uncertainty you talk about.
Very definitely. But, you know, it needs collaboration. You cannot innovate on your own. And this notion that innovation emerges from an individual who has really worked hard at something, thought about it deeply, committed and engaged with it very, very comprehensively, and all of a sudden there's this eureka moment, a waha moment, it doesn't work that way. And there was a wonderful book. You, in fact, forced me to read that book, and I'm so pleased you did. It was called The Innovators.
I wouldn't say forced, I encouraged, and then said, here's a book, why don't you read it? And then next week, come and review it. That's not forcing, that is encouraging.
It was the week. The week was the force. It was a 350-page book in a week, a school week on top of it, by the way, Bruce, just as a quick reminder. But the message in the book.
Has anybody got any violin?
The message in the book. Yes. It was written by Walter Isaacson, who had also written a book on Steve Jobs. He'd written a book on Einstein. He'd written a book on a few illustrious individuals. And he had argued in all his previous iterations that it really was genius insight that led to these individuals superseding and advancing ideas beyond that of normal people. And yet in the book, The Innovators, when he spoke about how the internet came about and how it was prevented from being a military instrument only and what it's done for society today, he spoke about the collaboration between big business and small business, between government, between academic institutions, between social activism. And those five elements, along with some very, very committed people, really led to a completely new way of dealing with things through the internet. And we are not good at that in South Africa. We are not good at collaboration. There is no trust between government and business. There is no trust between government and business. There's very little trust between big business and small business. Academia, I'm not sure where academia is at the moment, because we don't really see much coming from academia. We don't see...
there's no budget left.
It doesn't need budget. It needs inspired thinking. It needs to focus on what matters and what counts. You know, I look at how things occur in certain parts of the United States, Bruce. They've got contrarian thinking. They've got the best and the brightest from right around the world. They've created environments where your genius, your insight, your ability to work with people, all these fine features we're talking about are heavily rewarded. And guess what? If it fails, you're admired, because what you would have seen and what you would have learned gives you further insight, deeper insight. In fact, it makes you a better investment possibility. If you fail at something in this country, wow, it's very hard to stand up again. It's a dangerous, touchy task.
And that much is very, very true. I mean, that's the world of innovation. Why is it not happening? Pablo's told us why it's not happening. Do you feel it? Are you somebody who feels like you're an innovator? Are you somebody who feels like you were an innovator? You are somebody with great ideas. You just look at the environment around you, you just go, why bother? Which is would be devastating, but it's an important call. If you could give us a shout on 021-446-0567 or 011-883-0702. Or you're somebody who is of an innovative mindset and you said, the environment doesn't matter for my innovation. Some of the greatest innovations in history have been created at some of the darkest times in history. And certainly in South Africa, that much is true. Great businesses forged in the fires of uncertainty made them resilient and tough right from day one. Let's talk about those this evening on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. More with Pablo in just a minute.
The Money Show.
Small business.
We're talking innovation this evening. Why is it that it's just not firing? But Mukondi in Roodepoort, you've got something.
Yeah, John, Paulo, it's usually very enlightening hearing you speak and very inspirational, but today I'm feeling quite a bit depressed.
No, don't be, please.
My question is this. I've got an invention, I've got an innovation that perhaps I want to take to market. I'm talking on behalf of many other people that perhaps are in my similar situation, but what do I do? And if you're saying that the soil in South Africa is not fertile enough to then breed and make this innovation grow, what can I do going forward?
Without without giving away your IP, just give us a bit of a clue as to what it is, where it fits.
Okay.
A sense of it.
Okay, basically it's a fuelless generator that uses wind, solar and magnetic power to generate electricity, but you just attach it to one of the devices that you use every day, and it basically just makes power for you.
Okay. I mean, is it in development? Have you started production, or is it a sketch?
It's still in development, still in the research and development phase.
Okay. Have you sort of researched where you can manufacture it? Would you plan to produce this item in South Africa?
I've not gotten that far yet.
Okay.
We're still working on our prototype, and we are looking for partners that can perhaps help us to bring it to market. But my main question is that going forward, would South Africa be the market for it? Would it be an international product? But what I'm mainly asking is that since South Africa is not fertile, where can one take an innovation? It doesn't have to be in green energy. It can be in your workplace. It can be in radio.
Thank Mukondi, I get you, thank you. But I think Mukondi's got the wrong end of the stick. We're not saying that people like Mukondi's innovations don't matter. What we're saying is there are not enough people like Mukondi who are doing the innovative work to change the environment in which we live. Isn't that what we're saying?
Yeah, very definitely. Very, very definitely. So if I'm in your shoes, Mukundi, the way that I'm going to look at it is you're inventing this new appliance, this new capability, and what it does, it's going to generate electricity. Unfortunately, we have Eskom in the way. With Eskom retarding the IPP program, it's holding back a lot of the investment in green energy, and it's holding back and creating a lot of uncertainty around green energy. And you know, there was a very interesting tweet that I read the other day, Bruce, about the number of jobs that were created in the green tech space within the United States of America. And in a country like ours, where jobs need to be created, one would surely think you want to open up that spot, that part of the economy. Because in many ways, if we open up that part of the economy, it allows investment to come in, it allows certainty and stability to come in. And people like Mukondi and lots of other people who are coming up with ideas around electricity management and energy management would flourish in it, but they're not. So the approach that I would take, the first thing is, what you're building and what you're designing is not going to be suited to everybody. And it's really important to figure out who will ultimately be your customer. And whoever that ultimate customer is, Mukondi, I would go and find two or three businesses or people who would typically represent that customer for you. And I would involve them in the developmental process. And I would say to them, this is my idea. This is how it's going to work. How would you engage with it? Would it work for you? What problems will it solve for you? Because a good invention or a good innovation needs to attract funding in this particular instance. And what attracts funding is a gap in the marketplace, a problem that's not being solved for somebody who's prepared to have that problem solved and pay for it. So you need to start thinking with an investment mindset from day one when you're innovating. The next thing is, you need to think about a business that you're going to build around it. Because let's say you get this thing up and running, and let's say you get this thing built, and we'll talk a little bit about how you get to a prototype in a minute. But once you've got that thing built, how are you going to manufacture it and distribute it widely? How are you going to tell the world that you've got this answer? And how are you going to be sure that you're reaching the right people? So the plan around how you commercialize it is going to be an important feature. And the reason that that's important, if you need suppliers to come on board, or manufacturers to come on board, or people to help you with the prototype, or as you said, somebody to invest in the continued development of this, they're all thinking, right, it's a nice idea, it's an interesting idea, but how's it going to translate into a return for me? If I do this for Mukundi for free, and I go and I use my lathes and I use my CNC machines and I craft out the pieces and develop this particular product and I use my CAD instruments and I do the industrial design, and he's not paying me for it, and he's saying to me, if I do this for him, when he commercializes it, he will give me a return of A, B, or C. I need to see how you're going to commercialize it. So the commercial strategy behind the product, the innovation itself, is equally important. And then the final thing is, You've got to do some collaboration over here. Like you rightly suggested, you need to find one or two partners. And in many ways, if I look at the big innovations that have succeeded in South Africa, a lot of them, both here and abroad, succeeded because the driver of the innovation was not greedy. It's very easy to be a billionaire on Excel spreadsheets, but you need to get people on board. You need to get people committed. And in the early days, if you don't have the money, it means you need to share in the equity. So do the deals right to get the thing launched.
There we go, Mukondi. I mean, that's seriously how to exercise your innovation 101. And I've got an email this evening about a digital car wash, and it comes from Freddie. And he sent me a whole bunch of slides and things. And I mean, there's unfortunately no place called the Innovation Bank. Which is a pity, because people like Freddie and people like Mukondi would love to go to the Innovation Bank, which says, we love your idea. Right. We want to risk capital with you.
Yeah.
How do people like Freddie and Mukondi get some funding?
You know, Bruce, there's an entire department of science and technology in South Africa. And I had a really interesting engagement with the entire department on Friday last week at an event called the InnoBridge. And it was an attempt to try and demonstrate and showcase some of the innovations happening in South Africa. And what distressed me deeply is a lot of the people I met have got some of the sharpest minds and most committed minds and passionate minds around creating innovations or devices or gadgets or inventions that solve all sorts of really interesting problems. But there is no relationship between that department and its ability to commercialize and make it available to the public. And yet I look at it and say, open innovation is a well-understood concept. It's where innovations are properly broadcast, it's where innovations are made available, where they're made accessible. If the skill to commercialize something lies in the hands of an entrepreneur, which is the private sector, and should that department open up its innovations and invite the private sector in on a reasonable basis and on an open basis, so many of us who are looking for exciting things to do could find opportunity to the benefit of both the state and society, as well as the tax coffers and job creation. So we've got it all in theory, but none of it has actually landed on the ground in any practical means.
Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. It's a slightly gloomy way to end, but it's an important way to end because there are some great, thoughtful entrepreneurs, great, thoughtful innovators in South Africa, people with solutions to our problems, people who look at the world in which they live and they go, there's a problem I can fix, and you are fixing it. But yeah, it's more than connecting the dots. We have to sort of rewire the ecosystem. You see what I did there? I used jargon and everything. Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. Thank you.